Dirty Little Secrets of the Record Business, Why So Much Music You Hear Sucks, by Hank Bordowitz. Read by Hank Bordowitz. Introduction. My friends and acquaintances know that for the past 30 years or so, I have worked in one aspect or another of the music business. As a performer, recording artist, journalist, promotion person, marketer, engineer, producer, A&R scout, retailer, critic, crony, gadfly, and guide. Over the last decade, the question most people ask me is, whatever became of good music? Now, I realize good music is a pretty subjective phrase, but I also understand the sentiment. Once upon a time, as so many stories begin, you could tune into the radio and hear great things, musical revelations, as little Stephen Van Zandt said in the foreword to Richard Neer's excellent, and much cited in this book, FM, rock music had become my religion, radio my church, and these DJs my priests, rabbis, and gurus. They would preach from the Gospel of Dylan, Lennon and McCartney, Jagger and Richards, the Book of Townsend, the Song of the Birds, and the Acts of Davies. Righteous rock radio would continue on a bit longer, struggling valiantly into the 80s, and die quietly in the 90s like a spent stick of incense. In its place, anybody 21 years old or younger inherited a wasteland of corporate conservatism, tightly controlled, lifeless, depersonalized, deregionalized, homogenized DJs, spewing out depersonalized, deregionalized, homogenized playlists. Now, the real answer to these people is that there's probably more good music available now for the average person's consumption than at any time in history. The problem is hearing it, finding it, getting access to it, because no one is going to lay it in your ear anymore, though they might try. On the surface, little Stephen's wasteland of corporate conservatism would seem to be in control. But for anyone willing to scratch a little beyond the surface, there's a wealth of great sounds. In this book, I'll explain what happened to easily accessible good music, music that fans of WNEW in New York and KSAN in the Bay Area remember. It sometimes still exists in odd enclaves like public radio in L.A. and Newark, but you gotta get hip to know that the programs like Morning Becomes Eclectic or Rhythm Review are out there. Music isn't going anywhere, but music fans who know what they like will have to go into hunter-gatherer mode to get it. Not long ago, I had the opportunity to pull several classes full of undergraduate college students from a good-sized state college in suburban New Jersey as to their favorite radio stations. The answers genuinely surprised me. Over half of them said that when they listen to the radio at all, they usually listen to the classic rock station out of New York City, which plays much of the music Steve Van Zandt was talking about. This means that many of these people, just entering their third decade of life, listen to music recorded largely before they were born. It breaks a paradigm that goes back to Socrates and before, that every generation listens to music their parents hate. This generation is listening to the same music that their parents listened to, and finds it superior to the music of their contemporaries. Classic rock is one of the most successful formats on radio today for more reasons than just parental nostalgia. When we examined why, the answer came down to quality, musicianship, and a message. They said that, by and large, the music of their generation lacks these qualities. This boils down to a large number of disenfranchised, shell-shocked music fans who want to know exactly what happened. Dirty Little Secrets of the Record Business, Why So Much Music You Hear Sucks, will explain that, offering to satisfied music lovers a reason for the fall of popular music. This book lays out, in very specific terms, how the system that turned music into a commodity ultimately failed, trivializing its product and the user of that product. That would be us, the music fans. Once you finish reading, you will have a better idea of why today's popular music sucks, and maybe even a reason or two to hope that things will improve. The music business has come up with some fascinating rationales for their slumping sales. Imagine if General Motors started to assess some of the reasons for declining sales and it came up with people selling used cars, people selling third-party parts, and people buying parts at a junkyard. So it started to lobby for laws against the secondhand sale of its products. Or envision the post office declaring that mail was its intellectual property and starting to sue providers and users of email. Sounds ridiculous? It's what the record business has been up to for years. It has spent the last decade trying to find a fall guy to account for declining sales. The upstart technology of the internet did throw the music business for a loop, but the music business's reaction to this disruptive technology bears scrutiny, if only for how it mirrors the fortunes of other businesses. Is it possible that in reacting like a business, and like many businesses before it had acted, the music industry really couldn't help trying to maintain the status quo? With several down years behind it, the industry is in big trouble. The powers that be blame digital file sharing and CD burning for the business's woes. Yet evidence shows that file sharing might actually help sell physical copies. The record industry's finger-pointing hides the multifaceted reason for the industry's decline, the dirty little secrets of the record business. The amount of money and energy used to create this smokescreen is just one of the reasons why so much music you hear sucks. Cognoscente and the music business point to a host of problems of longer standing than the World Wide Web to account for their waning fortunes. There has been consolidation in all aspects of the music business, including the PolyGram Universal merger, the rumored future Sailor merger of EMI, the buying spree that led to Clear Channel owning nearly half of the U.S. radio business and its offshoot, Live Nation, close to 80% of the live music business. Would-be songwriter and booze heir Edgar Bronfman getting squeezed out of Universal, buying the venerable Warner Music Group, and taking it public. The merger of Sony Music and Bertelsmann Music Group, a record company initially run by a former television executive. The rise of these publicly held companies requires that record labels, as competing parts of these entertainment conglomerates, seek short-term profits to answer quarterly to stockholders. They do this in lieu of developing the career artists that traditionally fueled the business. Independent promoters maintain a stranglehold on both the radio and record business. The business continues to concentrate on what they have always regarded as their demographic, 12 to 25-year-olds, ignoring the plethora of entertainment and leisure choices this age group now enjoys, and the people who grew up in an era without so many options who consider music part of their being. There are many more reasons, though, including systemic problems with the way the record industry does business. This book reveals and analyzes these factors, many of which even industry professionals don't know about, since one facet of the business often doesn't know how the other facets operate. For example, I once had a student in my Introduction to the Music Business class in New York who worked as the director of A&R for a large, popular, successful record company run by one of the top young music business entrepreneurs of the 90s. After the first class, I asked him if this might not be too basic for him, as he likely made more money from the music business than all the other people in the room, including me, combined. He said that might be true, but he still had no idea what the people in the office next to him were doing. With one hand not knowing what the other is doing, is it any wonder that the popular music business faces such big trouble? Of course, many take the position that actually making money from music somehow dilutes the music's purity, that the best music gets made under the rubric of art for art's sake. And while plenty of prefabricated music, made only to keep the sluices of the machine lubricated, contributes to why so much music we hear sucks, making music for money is not inherently evil or even a bad thing. The reason the subtitle of this tome reads, Why So Much Music You Hear Sucks, and not Why All Music You Hear Sucks, is that some commercial music actually speaks to people artistically, and some independent music is utter crap. One of the great things about art is that there are no absolutes. Music that ignores the audience defines self-indulgence and borders on or goes right off into pretentiousness, while popular, that is, what people like, defines popular music. And sometimes the reason might even be the music rather than the marketing. People have made money from music for millennia. Music itself has been around nearly as long as humans have been thinking animals. There are paintings of flute players in Neolithic caves in Tanzania, and it stands to reason that before developing a specialized tool like the flute, people would use their voices and hit things to keep time for dancing and ceremonies. Playing music would have been mostly an amateur activity, dating from the days when humanity began to have time for recreation. Even these early instruments were generally created by the musicians, again as recreation. So when did music go pro? When I pose this question in class, students will often cite Edison or even point to the advent of rock and roll in the 50s. But actually, the Bible refers to musicians playing in the courts of King David and Solomon, and one would imagine that such performers would get paid. A millennium after that, the Greek theater used music and paid the musicians who played there. So, music became a profession sometime before the Common Era. That's at least 2,500 and probably more like 4,000 years of professional music. The theater tradition spread to Rome and the entirety of the Roman Empire. The theaters were often used for animal fights and large meetings, too, and beyond the tragedy and comedy of the day, ballets and musical performances were held, once again using people who were paid to play. In all of these settings, musicians were divided into two classes, people who played for money and people who played it for recreation. Very few of the people who played for money could do it as their sole means of support. Sound familiar? In the Middle Ages, there were two chief means of making money, even a living as a musician. Jongleurs and minstrels tended to be vagabonds going from town to town, entertaining at weddings and the like. If they were lucky, they could find a wealthy patron. Some of these relationships became long-standing. The formal minstrel could become the manor's music master, if the manor could afford such a luxury. Sometimes the relationship would last through the winter, the minstrel entertaining after meals and for company, perhaps giving lessons to other, usually younger, members of the household for room, board, and a small stipend, maybe. Another major employer of musicians during the Middle Ages was the church. Their musicians could be from the various orders or from the laity. Johann Sebastian Bach, for example, played the composed church music. Indeed, such notation as we know it emerged so that the music could be sent from church to church, country to country, a sort of lingua franca among musicians. This started happening across Europe around the 13th century. So through the Middle Ages, several classes of musicians emerged, each beholden to one master or another. The court musicians, the direct descendant of the manor musicians, who were treated like servants by the nobility. Church musicians, who often pursued other lines of work as well. Bach, for example, sold spirits. And itinerant musicians, the minstrels and klezmerim, who went about playing weddings and other events when they could. With the emergence of the Renaissance and a European middle class, and as the craft of playing music well became more rarefied and musicians emancipated themselves from the courts, musicians' guilds sprang up across Europe. These guilds weeded out poor musicians, an audition was required to join, and offered their members some legal protection and clout, helped them get work, and furthered their training. But mostly they offered a certain level of prestige that allowed musicians to emerge as part of the rising middle class. The guilds set payment standards, stabilizing the market. About the same time, a goldsmith by the name of Johann Gutenberg created a method for setting type. It was soon discovered that movable type could be set for other symbols, including musical notation. At that point, the question became who owned the music, the person who wrote it or the person who printed it. Publishers started to buy compositions from composers, but ultimately the publishers and composers agreed on a royalty situation, splitting the proceeds 50-50, a foreshadowing of their current relationship. This led to the question of how to protect the creator's interest and how to keep creators creating. In France, the concept of protecting ideas became codified about midway through the 18th century. Nascent America followed suit with its first nationwide set of laws, the Constitution. In Article 1, it states that Congress shall have the ability to promote the progress of science and useful arts by securing for limited times to authors and inventors the exclusive rights to their respective writings and discoveries. With this one line, the concept of copyright and intellectual property came to the New World. Musically, this was not of much consequence. No major intellectual property issues arose in the music business until 1850, when a piano mechanic named John McTammany invented the pianola, or player piano. He discovered, however, that making the instrument and marketing it were two different matters, and the pianola didn't really catch on until he sold his patents to the Aeolian Organ Company in 1888. It took 11 years, but at the turn of the century, the pedal-operated player piano, using music recorded onto a perforated roll of thick paper, hit the market. Within a few years, you could find them in 75,000 homes and businesses. Over 1 million piano rolls were sold. By 1920, the pianola had turned into a $20 million annual business. In 1921, of the 341,652 pianos sold, nearly 60% were mechanical. This created a question within the music business. had to pay the composers for these perforated rolls of paper that were playing their music. It wasn't the same thing as sheet music or folios of songs. This was a mechanical reproduction. Eventually, each roll sold entitled the composer and publisher to a mechanical royalty. In a few more years, this concept would become even more important, as we'll see when we deal with contracts and rights. So music has meant money for millennia. As much as the phrase music business defines what has turned into a giant ruminant digestive system for sound, it also functions as an equation. Music more or less equals business. Even the artists who play only for themselves and friends get involved in musical commerce. They buy instruments, sheet music, and especially records. But even before Edison embedded sound on tinfoil, music and business had an uneasy partnership. Whether the music sucks or doesn't, a highly subjective and personal matter, a ton of money gets spent in the production, promotion, and ultimately the sale of all things musical. Where money goes, greed, and all of greed's henchmen, avarice, bullshit, corruption, deceit, come into play. Which gets us to the meat of the matter. All ruminant digestive systems produce meat, after all. Because as much as the artist gets the music into the fan consumer's hands and ears, the business creates the context for the commerce. And as it works today, it only builds on what has worked before. Throughout this book, I'll be picking points in history when certain practices became paradigms, showing how they became part of the popular music mindset. The precarious tightrope team of art and commerce play few more dangerous venues than popular music. For music to stay healthy, for musicians to both thrive and have time to create, money must grease the wheels. However, when the money becomes highbound, can the other side of the equation avoid getting affected? Will the music business pull an Ouroboros, swallowing its own tail, threatening to consume itself until it simply disappears? Or will it emulate the phoenix, growing old and burning itself out, only to arise better and more beautiful from the ashes?